Today, another song for climbing God's hill.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
We are going through five songs of ascent this summer. And so I want to share another one with you, Psalm 126. These are the ones that are pretty much bunched together from Psalm 121 or so to Psalm 134, right around there. And we're on Psalm 126 today. This is only the second one I'll cover with you. I've covered a few of these in other contexts, so we won't go back to those. These are all different ones. Daisy picked them out for us to go through this summer. So on Psalm 126, again, the explicit superscript is a song of ascent. So it is written for people who are climbing up to the temple. They are ascending to Jerusalem, which is the common expression, I am told, by people who live in Israel for going to Jerusalem. You don't just go to Jerusalem, you go up to Jerusalem. And in the same way, when you're in Jerusalem, you go up to the Temple Mount. And so a song of ascents, which is in the King James, I think, translated a song of degrees, but it means steps. You know, you're taking steps up to the temple. That's the idea. So these are songs approaching worship. And you can see that in how they're written. And it makes sense. I mean, it's like saying this is a hymn for what? Well, for worship. Okay. So when you're going to worship, sing this hymn. But these are songs for approaching worship, how we're coming to it. And on this one, I think it's particularly important that we recognize, and you'll see why I say this in a moment, because it's written in halves, and the two halves sort of have an opposite approach to the same subject. And so, it's important for us to remember as we're approaching these songs and as we're approaching the temple that it's for everyone who's coming to worship. There are people who come to worship because they have something to celebrate, and there are people who come to worship because they are doing anything but celebrating. And by the way, there are people who avoid worship for both of those reasons as well. Oh, my life is so abundantly blessed now, who needs God? And they don't say the words, but that's what we do. Oh, life is so easy, who needs to think about praying, or who needs to think about going to church, or whatever. And there are people whose lives, when they are facing loss, when they're facing something that would bring lamentation to most of us, turn against seeing God. They just are a little angry at him, or sometimes a little more than a little angry at him, or disappointed, or afraid, or whatever the emotional state, withdraw from worship. So all of that can happen to people. I'm not saying everyone shows up for worship when they celebrate, but when people are coming to the temple, and if you were writing a song for people who are coming to the temple, you would have to be aware that some of the songs you're writing would be used by people who are celebrating and some by people who are grieving at this time. And this particular psalm is perfect for both when they come to worship. There's built into it, because of the language that's used, you'll recognize it as soon as I start reading it to you. There is built into the language of this psalm sort of a recognition of the eschatological nature of our relationship with God, meaning that we're waiting for something, that we're looking forward to a time that hasn't been realized yet. And so in this psalm, the language, when the Lord turned the captivity of Zion, or restored the fortunes, as the ESV says it, the language that's being used invokes and also invites a recollection of the language that's used in Psalm 68. That's the one that I've covered already that uses this language, but it's also the one that Psalm 68 that most likely is being cited in Ephesians 4 in a passage that we're all familiar with that refers to the captivity. He, you know, ascended on high and led a host of captives, the ESV says. In the King James, it's that led captivity captive that makes us all, you know, raise our eyebrow and squinch our forehead and go, what does that mean? What on earth? And so that phrasing invites this context that's appropriate for the psalm today. But where it shows up in Psalm 68, I think will give enough of a little background that I want to mention it to you. And this psalm is so brief, six verses long, that we have a moment to look at Psalm 68 and just think about it. Now, I'm not going to go back and read it all to you. I do want to read one verse out of it to you, the famous verse, the one about leading captivity captive and whatever that means. That psalm capitalizes on a completely different set of metaphors than this one. That psalm is about all the mountains, Mount Sinai, Mount Carmel, Mount Gerizim, which is, you know, the one that goes with Ebal, where the curses and the blessings are pronounced, Mount Bashan, which is Mount Hermon, which is to the north, and just this giant high-rising mountain that looks over all of Israel, so to speak. And then Mount Zion, obviously. All those mountains are features in Psalm 68, and in the middle of that psalm, Psalm 68, verses 15 through 19, there's a particular section about, and it's using the metaphor of Bashan, Mount Hermon, the giant mountain that looks over all of Israel, in the metaphor it does. That section of the psalm about Mount Bashan is about how God responds when his people are surrounded by their enemies who are looking down on them. Why are you looking down on us, Mount Bashan? That's what it says. And so it's like all the nations that are surrounding them are looking down on Israel in a dark time. And in the midst of that statement, which is Psalm 68, verses 15 through 19, it has that famous verse that says, "But you ascended on high, leading a host of captives in your train and receiving gifts among men, even among the rebellious, that Yahweh, God, may dwell there." And so it's a, you know, a restoration. You know, our enemies look down on us, but now you've won the war and you're bringing us back from our captivity. So the enemies aren't looking down on us anymore. In fact, they're cowering before you, in language that's used in another place in the Psalms, but they're cowering before you and bringing gifts to you. Now everybody is serving you. It's sort of a reminder that even when our enemies are looking down on us, we look forward to the day we know that our enemies are going to be looking up at you and giving you the gifts. That's what's going to be happening. That's how the psalm presents it. Now, the way, and again, the captivity language, while confusing to us, I mean, to them, it all has to do with the spoils of war. So when you're leading captives, you have won. And now you have in your train all the spoils of your victory, not just their objects, but the people. They're following you. They now belong to you, and so on. So you lead captivity captive, but when the captives, and the language is used for people, but also for objects, for the spoil, and it's used when you're the captive, but it's also used when you are the one being released from captivity. You're leading the captives out of where they used to be in captivity, that kind of idea. That's obviously what's going on in the psalm. You've returned us from our captivity. So however those idioms work, it gives you a lot of flexibility in understanding what's happening in the moment. And so flexibility can be confusing sometimes, but I'm giving you the range of options because that's precisely what's going to happen in this psalm. In verse 1, and then again in verse 4, when the same kind of phrase is used, that the Lord restores our fortunes, it's translated in the ESV, or returns our captivity, as it's translated in things like the King James. Okay, so anyway, in Ephesians 4, the other place that uses that phrase, and the place that probably either directly or indirectly is quoting or at least alluding to Psalm 68's use of that phrase, Ephesians 4 is the one where he says, therefore it says, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives. He led captivity captive. He led a host of captives, and he gave gifts to men. That's the quotation in Ephesians 4:8. The context of that, though, is really important for us to understand what I mean by saying this is sort of an eschatological psalm. The context in Ephesians 4 of all of that is that he says one Lord, one faith, as you know, we're just sort of picking it up in the middle in verse 5 of Ephesians 4. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. That's obviously eschatological. You know, there's a day when we're going to realize the unity that comes when God is over all and in all and everything. And it's the same kind of language used in the resurrection chapter of 1 Corinthians 15, when Jesus brings back to the Father all things, and then all is all in him, you know, and so on. So it's that kind of eschatological language. It's followed by saying, but here's our present grace. Our future grace, we realize God is all in all. Our present grace is this, starting in Ephesians 4, 7, but grace was given to each one of us according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore, it says, and it doesn't have the same introduction that you normally have for scriptures. So that's why there's a little flexibility on understanding what's going on here. We don't know for sure what's going on here with this quotation that's coming, because it doesn't quote it quite right, right? And so I say that like it's easy and simple to know whether it quotes it right or not. But I mean, it doesn't feel right, because in the original passage, Psalm 68, what it says is, you ascended on high, leading a host of captives in your train, and receiving gifts among men. You are receiving gifts among men. In the quotation that Paul uses in Ephesians 4, he says, therefore it says, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives, and he gave gifts to men, not received them. And there is a difference, obviously. But it makes sense interpretively, so maybe there's an early church hymn. Nobody knows exactly why he quotes it exactly the way he does. But the meaning is distinct enough that you know it didn't just slip in. Somebody didn't just misinterpret what was going on. There's some intentionality to this. And however it gets there, whether it's through a hymn or an indirect allusion or Paul just saying, hey, now he doesn't just have the gifts, he's giving them out to us. However he's getting there, that's the point, that what Christ has received, he's now giving to us. And so we live in a grace in the present time that tells us that this time also belongs to the one to whom eternity belongs. So this time is shaped by those gifts that are given to him in eternity when the enemies bow before him. But our present reality is shaped by that, because we're receiving those gifts from him now. Now, that's all Psalm 68, and we talked about that back in Psalm 68. So now, as I start to read Psalm 126, I'm hoping that context might help a little for us to understand this odd phrase, because again, it's just not us. We're not all going off to war, and even if we did go off to war, we wouldn't think of coming back with spoils. And if somebody did come back with spoils, we'd think they probably stole it. You know, that's not what you're supposed to do at the end of the war, if you're stealing things from the other. And we certainly wouldn't think of bringing people back with us as if they were in some kind of imprisonment before. So this is it would be a challenge otherwise. So I'm hoping it'll help us in understanding how the psalm works. Okay, let's start the psalm itself. Psalm 126, a song of ascents. When the Lord restored, the first three verses are all describing something that's already happened. When the Lord restored, and the Lord is Yahweh, when Yahweh restored the fortunes, or turned the captivity, or repented regarding the captivity, but it's probably transitive. So he's turning us. He's turning what's happening to us, which is why the ESV's translation makes sense. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, when he turned the captivity of Zion, this is how great that was. We were like those who dream, which also tells you that even in this looking back on something God has blessed them with, they're already acknowledging the sort of eschatological nature of it, meaning, and I'm not trying to use eschatological in some, you know, $10 self-righteousness sense of theological expertise. I mean, we're waiting for heaven. We're waiting for perfection. We're constantly waiting for Godot, you know, to use the play. When is it finally going to come? When is it going to happen? And their statement is, we experienced it. We saw God do something that we would only have thought of in a dream before. So when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, and I'll go back and try to read all three verses now. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter, and our tongue with shouts of joy. Then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. And then the next verse, verse 3, it closes. The Lord has done great things for us. We are glad. Those three verses, you know, obviously have this celebratory nature to them, which, again, if we put it back in context, we're given this psalm, we're given the phrases, are, you know, a really celebratory phrasing for us to bring into the presence of God when we worship him. So the congregation comes in and gathers, and they take up this song and they sing it, and they all pat each other on the back and hug each other and celebrate walking out of the service. You know, that's the kind of language that's being used in the poem so far. It's all that positive. So the statement, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, when he brought us back to Jerusalem from captivity, or when he brought us out of our desolation finally to this mountaintop where we could be in the presence of God and celebrate his presence among us, we were like those who before had only been dreaming, only been imagining it. Now, I am going to pause here and do this now. I thought about doing this at the very end with the whole psalm, but I just, as you're hearing it, I want you to be able to think about it as well, that you would apply this same statement to the people next to you in the congregation as you're worshiping who are not celebrating, who are lamenting the death of their son, or someone who didn't return from the war, didn't return from captivity. You know, all of us, we came back. Hey, where's your wife? Oh, well, she didn't make it. Then, you know, just saying we celebrate without acknowledging the grief would be a shallow, and it would be a disservice to the truth, because our celebrating is to be honest. We don't need to cloak things in order to celebrate this kind of God, the absolute God. So we're like those who dream really carries with it two kinds of meaning, and because there are two kinds of worshipers, two kinds of congregants. The ones who are in celebration saying, ah, we're finally experiencing now what we formerly only dreamed might become true. And in this context, in the way it's translated at least, and it's the translation assumes, you know, the nature of tenses in English that aren't present in Hebrew, so you have even a little more flexibility. But in the way it's translated, which again, I like and I'm embracing, we're saying we are now experiencing what we formerly only dreamed might become true in our celebration. But also, you know, we look back on the time when we were actually celebrating the things we just barely even imagined could happen in this life. That's what we're doing. In celebration, that's how you would take the statement, we were like those who dream. But in lamentation, it would also have a meaning for someone who's reading that. And they would say, looking back, you know, in that time, we actually experienced what now we're only dreaming about, we just wish could be true. And so it would apply to both congregants equally. I mean, in different ways, but equally well. The second verse, when it says, then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue was filled with shouts of joy. And I'll just remind you that none of this is artificial. None of this is supposed to be, well, now it's time to shout. Okay, hey, everybody shouts. It's not manufactured. It's the joy that comes from triumph, from raising your arms and saying, yes, you know, it finally happened. That kind of celebration. That's the joy that's being expressed in the realization that's either happening now or we know, we remember when it happened. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue was filled with shouts of joy. And again, it would be like the thing we were dreaming for. And so either we were dreaming of that and now we recall how great that was, or we are dreaming of that, but we recall a day when we saw evidence that it could actually happen, whichever way you take that, depending on where you are in the time you're coming to worship. But then the last half of verse 2, And then verse 3 really drives home where this goes forward. Then they said among the nations, because remember the language that's being used about the celebration is that the Lord has returned us from our captivity, or turned our captivity from being surrounded by the enemies to now triumphing and walking behind our king back to the celebration that he's provided for us. So then they said among the nations, Yahweh has done great things for them. So others realize it. And that would be enough. I mean, just for other people, that would make the point of this psalm in verse 2, for other people to be looking at Israel or to be looking at the people of God now and saying, man, the Lord does things for them, doesn't he? I mean, when you want to know what it means for something to have been accomplished, Yahweh has done it for them. Just look at how he's provided for them. So others realize it, but I think this is supposed to be more than that, because the idea of captivity, that those who dominated us, those who probably mocked us in taking us, beating us, conquering us, owning us, belittling us, they now see us and envy. Or at least, even if it's not supposed to portray envy, they at least hold us up as the testimony of good things God is able to do. Man, look what God is doing for them. So others realize it. And then verse 3, which is, I think, the clincher to this whole section. I mean, it certainly closes the section. They don't say anything about what everybody else is saying. They don't even say, and we say. They just say it. Yahweh has done great things for us, and we are glad. That moment, you know, in this psalm is arriving in heaven. It's lifting your head above the waters and realizing that you're breathing heaven's air instead of misery's air again. That's the moment. The Lord has done great things for us, and we're celebrating it. We're happy about it. We're finally here. We realize it. And I have mentioned before that over the last year and a half or so, I've spent a lot of time at a property that belongs to my in-laws that are just, you know, it's a really nice piece of property, but it has a lot of woods on it. So it has a lot of trees. And trees are just fantastic. I love trees, except when I'm trying to do my astronomy and every time the wind blows. I mean, the wind blowing through trees sounds great. It's wonderful. You know, the quiet hush of the wind just making its way through all the leaves. Wonderful. And then there's that crack and another crack and then thud. And then you realize something is on the ground that's not supposed to be on the ground. The whole tree, a big portion of the tree, something is crushed. Something is, trees are, you know, that's, I mean, we love them, but that's the price you pay for having trees. And so that happened the other day. I mean, we've had there are so many storms down there, so many things, so often the wind blows. It's not that far from the coast. And so there's a lot of coastal storms and things like that that come up, including, you know, the residue of hurricanes and such. You would think that all the deadness would be out of the trees, but no, there's always more. And so anyway, I'm down the other day and didn't even realize anything had fallen out of a tree. And I'm, you know, going down to work near a burn pile that we have down there. And lo and behold, there's this tree on the ground. And then I look around and it's like, well, none of the trees are down. So where on earth did this tree come from? Because that's weird to have a whole tree. And I mean, it's a pretty big tree that's down on the ground. And then I look up and I realize it's not a whole tree. It's just a significant limb and all the branches that go with it from this giant water oak that's down there not far from the burn pile in that piece of property. And so, you know, I was jokingly saying to someone else, man, you know, that giant oak tree that's down there by the burn pile. And they were saying, oh, yeah, I know the tree you're talking about. I said, yeah, a tree fell out of it because it was like that, like a whole tree had fallen out of it. And I think I think sometimes we miss the joy or the enormity of the gift God has given us because we only see this portion of the celebration that we can have about that in comparison with other people. And so what I'm saying is this, it's simple enough. When it says at the end of verse 2, they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. I think that's them stumbling across a tree on the ground, you know, and loving it. You know, hey, here's some wood I can cut up and take for a fireplace, and I can make some good stuff out of it, which is what we'll do. It's all good. And you do celebrate that, and you look at it, and you think, man, that is significant. Look at that tree. That's fantastic. And so they are, you know, seeing a tree. Oh, look at this. Look at this. It's really significant. The nations now, as we're leaving, as the Lord is blessing us and putting us back in our home, the nations are looking at us. And listen to what they're saying. Yahweh has done great things for them. Man, look at the enormity of that. And then you just look over to the side of it, and verse 3 pops out, and they say, I can almost not say it. The Lord has done great things for us. We are glad. Not, oh man, finally those people can see that we're the ones who are blessed. That's nothing compared to the fact that Yahweh actually has blessed them. Yahweh actually has blessed us. I think that the nature of that, I want to be so important in my life. I want it to be more important than it is. I want it to be better expressed than it is. But it is just the sense of gratitude. It is the reason we're supposed to, in everything, give thanks. In everything. Not because we've always arrived at the eschaton, but because God is constantly doing good things for us. And in the end, what we're going to realize is this enormous oak tree of reality in our relationship with Him is that the Lord has done great things for us. And we have a reason in that to be glad. So that's where the first half of the psalm leaves us, looking back on this moment. And I don't know which one it's supposed to be talking about, because I don't think it's trying to be particular. But it would certainly work if it's Egypt that their minds went to first, and some of them, that would be the first thing it would go to. If they were recently coming from a Passover celebration, then it would not be surprising for them to immediately go to Egypt, if in their minds, you know, oh man, remember when the Lord brought us out of Egypt and then established this capital city for us, and we climbed the hill of God and realized that our enemies were seeing how God had blessed us, and indeed God has blessed us. It could be Egypt. It could be coming back from Babylon. It would just depends on what's in the person's mind who's singing the psalm. And it doesn't change the objective nature of this part of the psalm saying, we remember how God has been good to us. Whether they're suffering now or celebrating now, they would be able to look at it and say, we've seen God do great things for us. Then starting in verse 4, we get the other half of the psalm. Restore our fortunes. The prayer continues. Now it's a request. Restore our fortunes. Not, we remember when God turned our captivity, but now it's a statement to God, return our captivity. Bring our spoils back. Bring back the fortune. So restore our fortunes, Yahweh. That, again, is not it's not directly in contrast with the first half of the psalm. It is, because we're asking for what we described having received in the first half of the psalm, but it's not in contrast with the whole context of our being, you know, worshipers of a Yahweh in a world that hasn't fully realized the goodness that's His yet. Because in the first half of the psalm, in the last half of the first verse of the psalm, it said, we were like those who dream. We were experiencing in that moment, briefly, what in reality in this world really only shows up in our dreams. It's not being realized yet. And so in that acknowledgement at the end of the first verse, we would expect a person in the last half of the psalm to say, could we get back there? Can we get back to that point where you're fulfilling the dreams that you've put into us, that you've caused us to have? Can you realize those dreams in us again? So restore our fortunes. And I won't go through the details of this, but if you take this psalm out and look at it sometime, you'll realize that step by step, it's very strongly parallel between verses 1 through 3 and verses 4 through 6. So it is, in verse 1, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, and in verse 4, restore our fortunes, O Lord. And where it is in verse 1, we were like those who dream. In verse 4, at the end of the verse, it is like streams in the Negev. That's how we want this to be, like streams in the Negev. Instead of a dream, that's the metaphor. And it just goes on all the way down through the bottom, because the shouts of joy are repeated and so on. So the parallels are so obvious. You're supposed to see the two parts of the psalm in comparison with each other. So this second half, restore our fortunes, O Lord, like streams in the Negev. I'm assuming that when you hear that, you know what it means. I know enough, though, to realize that there are some people who haven't seen this. I saw it because on my grandparents' farm that I was at in the summers when I was a little kid, they had these gullies that were like this, what would amount to a wadi if you were in the Middle East. But also when I was growing up in an urban setting, suburban, in Arlington, Texas, when I was growing up there on a street, Foster, I lived on Foster off of Fielder in Arlington, for those of you who wonder where my early childhood was when I came here from Crane to North Texas from West Texas. I lived on Foster, and at the end of the street, the Foster was on a hill, and at the end of the street, we were towards the bottom of the hill. At the bottom of the hill, there was another street that intersected it, Tatum. I think it was called Tatum. And just around the corner from our house at the bottom of the hill off the other street was a gully. And it was concrete. I don't know what else you would call it, but we called it a gully. It was concrete, and it was just a channel for the water to leave the street and flow through, not just down into a gutter, but if I remember correctly, because we never went to the other side, but the whole other side behind the houses that were there opened out into Randall Mill Park, a park, a pretty large park that was in Arlington, still is. And so the water would flow down there and be gone. So during storms, you can imagine it's at the bottom of a hill. There are quite a few streets that comprise this neighborhood. There was a lot of water that flowed down to that street and then flowed down that gully and back toward Randall Mill Park. Well, you know, it was dry the rest of the time, but when it did that, and I'll tell the other part of this story, and don't think negatively of my parents because they were right for doing this. It was fine. It was a different day. When it rained, and I think my mom would probably say, she's still, my dad has passed away, but my mom is still living. I think she would say, we didn't send you out when it was lightning, but I don't think that was true. I think, you know, if it was raining, it was like, oh, free swimming pool, go outside, you know, play in the rain. And that's what we did. We'd put on our bathing suits, play in the rain. It was the greatest thing ever. I will never regret that. I loved every single minute of it. And the water would be channeling down the curb line, you know, right next to the house. And I can remember kicking the water and putting every single toy character that I had at the top and watching it flow down and trying to catch it again before it would be gone forever, you know, that kind of stuff. Creating boats and having them float down. You know, you get the idea. So we played in the water. We played out in the rain all the time. Absolutely loved it. Greatest time ever. One of the things we did, we weren't supposed to do this because supposedly somebody died doing it. I doubt that's true, but that's what we were told as little kids. I don't even think my mom ever said that or my dad. I think I just heard it from other kids, you know, that their parents were telling them, don't play in the gully. You know, people drown down there. Because it was a rapids, but we did. We played in it because it was fun. You know, the water was flowing fast. And it wasn't a mile long. We're talking the length of a house's property, you know, in a suburban neighborhood. And so, you know, I don't know, 100 feet, something like that, 75 feet, I don't know, something. And so, you know, it would go immediately down. So you could put, if you had, we used to have these tree swings that were like tire swings, but it wasn't a tire. It was just a little round plastic thing that you put a rope through. Anyway, we'd take that off the tree, and it would sort of float and, you know, sort of scrape, but whatever. The water was flowing hard enough. You sit on that thing and you're going all the way to the end of the gully, right? And then there was a fence, you know, that would catch you, which I realize also might drown you if the water was deep enough, but it wasn't. And so we would, you know, slide down. It was sort of like sledding, but in the rain. It was a blast. When the water was there, celebration and glory and the greatest time you ever had in your life. I mean, you go down it and you can't get back to the top fast enough to go next, you know, and everybody was doing it. And I remember kids doing it with pieces of cardboard, which I thought was weird, but they did, and it worked, and it was fun. We just had a great time. And then 99 days out of the year, it's just a dry piece of concrete, you know, between these two houses. There was nothing, absolutely nothing. That's what this phrase is like. The statement, like streams in the Negev. In the Negev is the south, the deserts. It's just dry. The streams in the desert are not streams 99 days out of 100. They're just these patches of dirt and nothing. And in that, there's no celebration. But man, when the water starts flowing, you know? And that's what they're saying. Restore our fortunes is not just, oh man, we wish it could be a little better than this. It is. Our lives are dry. They're barren. They're empty. They're meaningless. They've been lost. Would you overflow them with the water that you send when you bless us? That's how they're seeing it. And by the way, the whole history of Israel traveling through the desert for those 40 years, or Elijah going through the desert for 40 days, or David having to go through the desert to flee from Saul, every journey that reflects the nation of Israel includes them going through the desert before they get to the water where God blesses them abundantly. And so this is, send the water, send the floods, because in those floods, there's joy. But in the meantime, verse 5, those who sow in tears shall reap with shouts of joy. So in the time when we don't have the joy, what we're singing to God after having remembered a day when the Lord had returned the fortunes of Zion, like, you know, those who dream, we were like them. Our mouth was filled with laughter. After we sing all those words, we come back to where we actually are, asking God for help. Restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev. And we do it with this confidence, not that he's going to restore them immediately, not that we can control when he's going to restore them, but with this knowledge that it is those who sow in tears, this is verse 5, who reap with shouts of joy. Those who sow in tears shall reap with shouts of joy. He who goes out weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, bringing his sheaves with him. That's the whole thing. You are now just sowing. Of course, yeah, it's work, it's sweat, it's grief, it's loss, it's sorrow. But you don't sow in the joy. You sow with tears. You reap with joy. And so, yeah, we pray, Lord, bring the harvest. But we don't presume the harvest is going to come before we've sown the seed. And the seed is sown with tears. That's how the psalm is written. That's the metaphor of the psalm. So taking each of those phrases in verse 5, those who sow in tears shall reap with shouts of joy, it's obviously, you know, something of a saying that they can apply to this hymn and sing together about the thing that they're going through. And it has built into it this more generic idea that we get from Ecclesiastes 11 that you'll recognize, using the same kind of metaphor, that you can only reap if you sow. You know, you have to sow, you plant seeds, and then you get to do the harvest. You don't walk out to a barren field, a plowed field, and just say, okay, well, let's start the harvest. You walk out to a plowed field and you start planting seed, and that has a lot of sweat and sorrow and grief associated with it. So in Ecclesiastes 11, I'm not going to try to read the whole thing to you, but the first four verses, cast your bread on the waters. You'll find it after many days. Give a portion to seven or to eight. And this has to do with giving to the poor. I think in Ecclesiastes 11, the statement is follow the law of God, sow the seed, do what is right. And in the end, God will bless you. He'll give back to you. You seek the kingdom of God and he'll bring all the other things to you. That's the idea. But in verse 3, it is, well, when the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. If a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, that's where it lies. And verse 4 puts it in the metaphor that we're using in Psalm 126. Whoever observes the wind would never sow. He who regards the clouds, therefore, would never reap. You can only reap if you sow. That's the idea. So the more generic concept of what verse 5 is saying is simply, if you want to reap, you're going to have to sow. But the more specific context is to say, the sowing in this case is a life that includes things that are hard and things that are that bring sorrow. So if you want the harvest, then you have to be willing to sow those seeds. In verse 6, that idea is carried forward also more clearly. He who goes out weeping, bearing the seed for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, bringing his sheaves with him. Let's just get back to the shouts of joy here for a second. In 2 Timothy 2, the way Paul gets at that, using different metaphors, some other metaphors, he finally arrives at the metaphor of agriculture, but he starts with one of soldiers. So share in suffering as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. After all, no soldier gets entangled in civilian pursuits since his aim is to please the one who enlisted him. You have to go through the hard part. Or athletics, the other metaphor. An athlete isn't crowned. Crowning, that's the sheaves of joy. That's reaping, right? But he's not crowned. An athlete isn't crowned unless he competes according to the rules. But that's hard. You have to follow the rules. Stay in your lane. Work. Do all the exercise. Do all the work. Verse 6 then brings it to this metaphor, the agricultural metaphor. It is the hardworking farmer who ought to have the first share of the crops. It makes sense that you would first labor and bear the grief that goes with being a farmer in order to reap the harvest. That's what happens. And in Ephesians 4, he does the same thing. Ephesians 4 being important because at the beginning of the discussion of this psalm, I mentioned it to you. It's where Paul is using the language of leading a host of captives. Restore our fortunes. Ah, he restored our fortune. He gave gifts to men. In that grace statement that he's using in Ephesians 4 that looks forward, isn't there yet, but looks forward to the day when the grace is realized in all being in God. But now it's the grace that he's given to each of us to live in. That's the context of Ephesians 4 that ends with this statement. In saying, that I'm quoting Paul again in Ephesians 4, in saying he ascended, what does it mean but that he also descended into the lower regions of the earth? He who descended is also the one who ascended far above all the heavens so that he might fill all things. There is no, in other words, Paul is saying, there's no ascending without descending, which means exactly the same thing. There is no harvest without sowing. There is no joy that comes without the grief that preceded it. And so this statement at the very end, bringing his sheaves with him, I mean, I've always heard this used when I was growing up. It was always used to describe, you know, sheaves that you would bring in from soul winning, for instance, or whatever the harvest of something else is. In this psalm, the sheaves are the joy. It's the fulfillment of the thing that we've been praying for. So he's bringing his sheaves of joy with him. He's shouting for joy. He's bringing the harvest with him. And in 2 Timothy 2, I'm just going to use that song that makes this point so directly. It's not even really metaphorical. It's just direct. The saying is trustworthy, the hymn that the New Testament Christians were singing. This is that hymn. The saying is trustworthy, for if we have died with him, we will also live with him. Dying comes before. If we endure, we will also reign with him. We endure first. If we deny him, he will also deny us. That's a sorrow, by the way. But even in that moment, if we are faithless, that's all the sorrow, all the failure, all the misery, he remains faithful. Not only does Paul say, oh, there's got to be sowing before there can be reaping, there has to be sorrow before there can be joy, but he makes it clear that all of the security of the joy, the harvest, the reaping, the benefit, the shouts, all the good that comes is because God is going to be absolutely faithful to bring us to that end. But in the middle of that hymn, everything he's doing is what this psalm is about. It is, if we have died with him, we will also live with him. If we endure, we will also reign with him. There's an aphorism, and people say it all kinds of different ways, and I'm sure it could be put more cleverly than I'm going to put it right now. But there's this aphorism that when things are at their peak, there's only one direction it can go. You know, so everything's great. Well, you know where it's going to go now. It can only go down from here. You know, all those kinds of statements. So there's that. There's the aphorism that when things are at their peak, there's only one direction they can go. And it's converse, another aphorism is, when you hit the bottom, there's only one direction to go from there, right? So, I hit rock bottom and, well, I only had one way I could go from there. You've heard people say those things. We know what it means in this life. You can't avoid it. We know what it means not to celebrate. We experience all the things in life that make every life a challenge. We don't pretend. We don't come to the Psalms saying, oh, let's just pretend that God did something. Let's dream. Let's just dream together. No. We remember days when God made it so that we were like those who only dream, but we weren't dreaming. And our prayer isn't to have a better dream. Our prayer isn't what's only realized in dream. Our prayer is a reality in contrast to the one we actually do fully, really experience in this life. We know what it means not to celebrate. We experience everything in life that makes every life a challenge. But this is more. This psalm does more. It says we celebrate precisely because we know what it means not to.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.